We're going to discuss a little bit the lives of children and adolescents in three settings, namely among Tibetan nomads residing in China. Secondly, I'm going to talk a little bit about a place in India called Ladakh, which also follows a Tibetan culture. And then Dr. Kim is going to talk about sort of education-crazy modern Koreans, right? And the purpose of these three examples is to try to show that the lives of children and adolescents have changed drastically over time, and depending on the environment in which a given society functions, right? So we call that a socio-ecological approach, and what I mean by this is when you look at childhood and adolescence, you should start, according to this outlook, by looking at the environment of a given society, the technological status of that society, and also certain other factors such as the medical knowledge of the society that influences heavily, for instance, how many children live and how many children die. And in our book, we start with the oldest type of society, namely what people often call hunter-gatherers, but those we're not going to discuss today, except I want to point out that for the first 200,000 years of Homo sapiens, that's what we were doing, right? But it gets us too far away from Asia, and I think most of you are more interested in Asian or Asian-American topics. In order to say something about these lives, at the end, we're going to look at some global trends. There are about 2.3 billion children below the age of 18 in this world. And we now have some rather good global statistics about what's happening in the life of these kids. Right? I originally got interested in the topic in a rather interesting situation. It was July 2000, and I was sitting in a jeep crossing the Himalaya Mountains to a region called Ladakh in India, which we're going to discuss later. And I'd been there several times before. I was looking forward to coming back. And we're crossing all these huge mountain passes. And finally, the jeep came to a halt because they were repairing the road. And about 10 yards from me, I was sort of looking up, there was a boy, about 14, 15 years old. He was not a local boy. I found out he came from Tamil Nadu in the south of India. In front of him was a huge rock. He had a chisel in his hand, and he apparently had spent much of his day chiseling away at that rock, which they needed for that road system. All right. So imagine for a moment you're 14 years old. You're probably not literate, or at best semi-literate. You spend your day chiseling away at a rock, and what your future is like, well, probably not too good. Now, I started thinking about this because I originally started my own life being a refugee, so it didn't start that easy. Right? I was in Germany, I lived in Berlin, we got bombed, the house was destroyed, we almost didn't survive, so it wasn't that easy. Right? Nevertheless, if I compared my life with that of this boy, there was no doubt that he had a tough fate. Right? I also had been in a carpet factory in India some years before in Kashmir. And so imagine for a moment a room, maybe half as big as this one, and you see about 7, 8, 9 girls, 8, 9, 10, maybe 11 years old. In front of them is this carpet. And I don't know whether you ever saw a person creating a carpet. You know, it's basically making a little knot, snipping away the top, next knot, thousands and thousands and thousands of knots. Pretty boring, right? Some of these girls, I later learned, become short-sighted because they're spending 10 hours a day doing this. Once they're about 12 or so, and puberty is around the corner, they're taken out of there. And when they're 15, 16, at least in those days, they get married. Of course, they have no choice in who they're going to marry. Right? That's sort of a negotiation between families, and it has to do with money more than anything else. Right? And I could give you other examples of this type of childhood. Right. So that got me thinking. I started to edit a book that was concerned with children around the world, but not American children, but children other parts of the world, because we psychologists in those days especially mostly talked about Americans and not too much about other parts of the world. But I want to talk about other parts of the world. I still like to do this. Right. That's how it got started. Now, the first kind of child is among Tibetan nomads who herd goats, sheep, yaks, cows that often are crossed with yaks, right? Who live way, way up on the highest plateau on Earth, called the Changtang sometimes. Right? And we're going to look at a region that on the map is in the upper right-hand corner, Qinghai. Right? But we're going to travel back in time. Specifically, we're going to rely on a book that is concerned with research on these nomads in the 1930s and 1940s, when these nomads still lived an independent life, sometimes in tensions with the Chinese, sometimes not, right? Whereas today this type of nomadic life still exists, but it's rapidly changing for all sorts of reasons. So if you now look at the map, look at the upper right-hand corner, it says Kukunoor Lake, right? And not far from there, that's the region where we're going to be now. I'll first show you a few pictures. These pictures were taken more recently. I didn't take them, right? So that's a horse race in Sichuan province, right? Every year they have these horse races, and that Tibetan nomad is trying to pick up these white kataks. Katak, you put it around the neck of a person, a lama blesses it, and so on and so on, right? So it has a symbolic meaning, but it has another meaning. Right. Some of these kataks belong to young ladies, and if he picks up the katak of a young lady, he can go to her, and you can imagine the rest. Right? It's a sort of a way of starting a romance. In the very background, you see towards the left this black thing there. That's a tent made from yak hair. That's where the nomads live. Right? Again, a recent picture. I think we all agree these ladies like to dress up. Right? And the guys in the background are also dressed up. Right? So this is actually taken, this picture, during one of these horse racing festivals. Right? Back in the 30s and 40s, they would have been less dressed up because they were poor in those days. But these days, for certain reasons, some of them have quite a bit of money. Here are some dancers. Uh, If you look at this nomad, you see at his back the picture of the Buddha, right? But you also see his blue jeans on, right? So the point of this picture is that the modern world is now coming to these nomads, and has been coming for several decades in all sorts of forms, right? Some people call that globalization because of blue jeans, you know, that were not invented in China or in Tibet or wherever. They came from the West. And the little boy there has a sort of a jacket on. This will be Grandpa. Still in the old style. He has in front of him what's called the Tibetan prayer wheel. Right. Inside there are prayers. Om Mani Padme Hum, for instance, is the most famous one, right? And you just turn it around, that's your way to pray. Right. The most interesting animals that these nomads have are yaks. I don't know whether you have ever seen one. You know, it's a big animal, rather unruly. Right? It's not easy to guide them wherever you want them to guide, but another name for a group of yaks is Nor in Tibetan, N-O-R, and that actually means wealth. Right? So to have a lot of yaks means you're wealthy by the standards of that society. Right? So, let's look at some life stages. This example is taken from another nomadic Trans-Himalayan group, and it specifically refers to girls. Right? It's a rather poor society, because in the old days they used to trade between India, Nepal, and China, but the border was closed, right? And so they're having a rather tough time. So you start out with a little baby. As in most traditional societies, these children are breastfed for 2 or 3 years. In the United States, the average child is breastfed about 6 months. Right? And this is true for quite a few other traditional societies. Then you become a daughter. Right? And you still have limited duties, but it's understood that you will help out in the household, either of your parents or grandparents, or both, right? And this is one important difference between most traditional societies and modern societies, right? In most traditional societies, we have quite a few children, and it is understood that from early on, these children will help. And I might seriously, right? They also often take care of their younger siblings, and that holds true especially for daughters. Right? Less so for the boys, but if there are not enough daughters around of the right age, then the boy will be asked to do this. And so you can easily see, and I've seen this hundreds of times, you know, there's this 5-year-old girl, and she's actually in the evening, she's playing, and there's the 2-year-old toddler she's responsible for. Sometimes she has the toddler on the back, right, or on the side, on her hip, or sometimes the toddler just sits there. Right. As the girl reaches sort of what's called middle to late childhood, 9 to 15, she is now basically a full-time working person. Right? And it's understood that she will learn these skills also for adulthood. Most of these kampa in the 80s, when this research was done, didn't go to school. Maybe 10 or 20%, usually some boys, but the large majority of the kampas were too poor and kids had to work, basically. Right? Then the daughter will be married off pretty early on. Also true in many, not in all, traditional societies. Right? And the society is patrilineal and patrilocal, which means that the descent is mostly counted in the male line, patrilineal. Patrilocal means that once you marry, you move into the household of your husband. Right? Our society is called neolocal, which means that most Americans, when they get married, move into a new household. In the patrilineal, patrilocal household, the new wife is now the daughter-in-law, and she comes under the control of her mother-in-law. And there is something that people sometimes call Asian mother-in-law problems. What they mean by this is, I think you can guess, you know, certain tensions. Right? The son, incidentally, often stays out of this. Right? So he's not defending his wife. How do you get out of this situation? Well, once you have a son or two, your status as this young wife goes up. That helps you more than anything else. Not the only one, right? It's less likely that you're going to get divorced for whatever reasons, right? And ultimately, you will be a person who has more influence and power in this type of household. And then, I'm not going to discuss it, you become a housewife, an older woman, and ultimately you became a grandma, and you retire. Right? So that's a fairly typical household that would have applied also in MDO with certain minor adjustments. So, what are these drokpa? Drokpa is a Tibetan word for people who live high up there in the mountains. Right? So what are they interested in life? Well, let's look at a name, Zering, which incidentally is a name that may be given both to young sons and young daughters. Right? It simply means long life, and it expresses the hope, right, that, in fact, our son or daughter will live a long life, especially since it is not always easy, and some of these kids will not have a long life. Then there's a saying among the Amdopa. Amdopa means people from the Amdo region, right? Many animals outside the tent, yaks, sheep, and so on. A group of prospering children, including boys, inside the tent. Right, that's a good life. And then, for women's goals, we might say, become what they call the mistress of the tent, right, which is most likely to happen if you're married to the oldest son of a given family. Right? And then you have several kids. You hope that one of those boys will be recognized. And I will say something perhaps later on how you recognize a boy like this as a reincarnated lama, because we are in a Tibetan Buddhist society, right, which for the mother means a big rise in status. Right? And you want to retire as a happy grandmother. You still try to help out, but you also now are praying for a good reincarnation. Because it's taken for granted that an average person will not reach nirvana, the ultimate goal of Buddhism, but will be reincarnated dozens and dozens of times. Okay? The proverb says a woman without children is often ill. So children are essential, right? And if a woman, for whatever reason, cannot have children, then maybe her husband's going to marry or take a second wife, right? Which he probably wouldn't have done without this situation. Moreover, men want to be a successful herder and trader. I will say something about this in a moment. Form alliances between one's family and other families. Avoid blood revenge, which was not uncommon among some, not all, of these nomads. Don't create problems with your local spirits. The whole world is full of these spirits. They live in the mountains, they live next to your tent, they live on the passes, they live everywhere. Right? Be known as a courageous warrior, in the old days especially. Right? And maybe you're the father of the head of a monastery, which would add a lot of prestige to you. Then, sometime in your life, you should make a pilgrimage to the capital of Tibet, Lhasa, which from Amdo takes back and forth something like 7 months. There was no road. You circumambulate these monasteries and these holy places, even holy mountains, because that improves your karma, which will improve your fate after death, right? And you also are being told that you should not cling to this cycle of existence, because the one certain thing is impermanence, right? That you know. Sooner or later, you will die and presumably be reborn. Right? So this is sort of like the philosophy. It's a picture of some Tibetans prostrating themselves around a mountain. The most famous mountain is called Mount Kailash in sort of in the autonomous region, the most holy mountain on earth, incidentally, because the mountain is also worshipped by 900 million plus Hindus, right? It's a little bit hard to see, but if you look at the person in the left foreground, he has a sort of wooden thing beneath his knees because he's going up and down thousands of times, right? And he also has a wood plate in his hands, right? And I've seen this quite a few times. Most of the time that we're going to do 32 miles, but it's certainly in a more modest way when you have a famous monastery that will go outside the walls of the monastery, also prostrate themselves in quite a few cases, right? And that improves your karma. Okay. So, now what about children? Children are very much expected, as we heard already, and early childhood in these nomad tents tends to be a pretty happy, rather relaxed way of growing up. They're not pushed very hard. Yes, they watch around, but they're not pushed the way that some other kids in pre-industrial societies are pushed. Right? They play, since they don't have any, in the old days, of course, remember we're talking about the 30s and 40s, right? They hardly had any toys, so they would imitate birds, play with sheep. If they're boys, they would learn how to throw stones with a certain... It's very hard to describe a certain whip which allows you to shoot at a goal 100 yards away and often hit it. I would not have believed it unless I see it, right? And so on and so on. From early on, the girls work harder than the boys because they have to help out, in the tent. And by about 7, 8, 9, the boys now take the big animals to the place where the grass is, which may be a few miles away from the tent. Right. There are no trees up there. It's much too high. That's why they're nomads, because you can't plant stuff. Right. And they become responsible from pretty early on for these animals. They have to defend the animals as 15-year-old boys against wolves, quite a few, especially in the winter time, snow leopards, right, and other foxes, the smaller animals, and other predators. Furthermore, in the winter, the temperature drops to minus 20 to minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit. And you're going to be out there for 8 hours, 10 hours or whatever. Right? So a nomad has to be exceedingly hardy to survive these temperatures. And to give you an example of this, when they come back into their tent, they cannot smile, because their faces are frozen. Right? I'm pretty sure none of us would survive this. Right? So, nomads are brought up from early on, both girls and boys, but especially the boys, to be tough creatures in many ways. They may also have to defend the boys or the young men, the animals, against human predators. Animals can be easily stolen. And remember, the name for yaks is wealth. Right? So it wouldn't be unusual for somebody to try to steal your animals. Right? Some of them had guns. Right. The guns didn't look like Western guns, but they were used to them from early on. Right. And they were also brought up to be proud. They looked down on peasants, both Tibetan peasants, some of whom were serfs, right, and they looked down on Chinese peasants, because a peasant is a peasant who works for somebody else. He is not free like a nomad. So freedom, right, is a big, big value in this type of society. Right? And it's a real freedom. You have to defend the freedom. Right? That is true. Right? But that's part of the glory. Right? So Matthias Hermanns, was a German, actually missionary originally, who published a book. It's in German. It's never been translated into English. And he was in Amdo, among these nomads, for years. He had medical training, and that allowed him not only to enter the tents, but also to establish connections to women who got sick or had to give birth or what have you. Right? He spoke the Amdo dialect as well as Chinese. Right? He spent quite a few years there. Right? And I found his book quite impressive, because it really paints the picture of a society that makes a lot of sense to me. I've met Tibetan nomads, but they're already changing, right? And I sort of like it better if you can see a book where the old style is still around. Right? The nomads, incidentally, often had problems with the Hui, H-U-I, Han Muslims, who tried to govern them, right? And who also sometimes attacked the monasteries, right? And we're talking about thousands of dead people on both sides sometimes, right? So this was not a necessarily a peaceful society. So, I've looked at other nomad societies in quite different parts of the world, and the description that you just heard is not unlike some other descriptions I have seen of traditional nomadic societies, right? And they're usually patrilineal, patrilocal, pretty aggressive, often steal animals, sometimes from farmers next door, so to speak, and so on and so on, right? So what has happened to these Tibetan nomads? I'm not going to go into the politics of this. Notice, first of all, Amdo was not a part of traditional Tibet. Right? There are about 6 to 6.5 million Tibetans today. There were fewer in those days, right? And less than half of them live in the autonomous Tibetan region. Right? On the other hand, they lived a pretty independent life before the communist takeover, right, when things started to change pretty radically within a few years. Right? So today there's a lot of pressure on them from the Chinese government. Right? In 1959, there was an uprising. The Tibetans rose up against the Chinese government. It actually started in Amdo. It didn't start in the Tibetan region, then it spread to the Tibetan Autonomous Region. And in 1959, when it became clear that the Tibetans couldn't win this, right, the Dalai Lama, their leader, both political and spiritual, fled to India, where he's still living. Right. So these days, the lives of these nomads has changed a lot. For instance, the Chinese government said, send your kids to school. But think about this. If you're a nomad, it's pretty tough to send a kid to school because that kid can't do anything in the going to be 200 miles away or 100 or whatever. And that's a problem, for instance, that you also see in Mongolia. Mongolia is a famous country that used to be basically a country of nomads for a long time, for hundreds and hundreds of years. So an increasing number of these kids now are sent to school. Often one or two kids stay at home in the tent. Others are sent to school, right, depending on how many children there are. But let me repeat, for the kids that are sent to school, it usually means that they're going to send to some town under 200, 300 miles away. They have to have the money to reside there in some way or other. They often go to school together with Chinese students. Often, they at first are instructed in Tibetan. It depends where you are, in which part of Amdo and so on and so on. But later, they have to learn Mandarin. In contrast, the Chinese fellow students grew up with Mandarin. It is obvious that as a Tibetan student, you are at a huge disadvantage. But you're told, if you want to have a future, right, which will not be up there in the mountains in the nomad tent, you must speak Chinese. Right? The Chinese government also says, look, we can't have these huge areas in the Changtung where you nomads just sort of spreading yourself thin because it's bad for climate control. The Changtung is now starting to melt, not just up in the Antarctic. Okay. The higher areas in the Changtung are what's called permafrost, meaning eternal frost. And it's now softening and melting, a very bad sign. Right. So the Chinese government is trying to do something about it, which is really tough to do. And one way they do this is they give money to the nomads. Remember the women that were all dressed up? That's in part Chinese money. Right? And tell them to move down into the valleys and build houses. Right? There are still quite a few nomads, but every year there will be fewer. And this is true, incidentally, in Mongolia as well. Mongolia is a different situation because the people there are Mongolians, and not a minority. Right? Nevertheless, many of them now move to the capital, go to school, because of climate change and other problems. Right? All right. So that's the first group. Now I'm going to talk about a second group, right? And we're going to move to Ladakh, right? Which is in Kashmir. Let me go back for one moment to a map. Okay. Look to the very left, and a little bit above half, it says Ladakh, right? It's in India. It belongs to Kashmir. It's partially Buddhist, partially Muslim. I've been there. I've done research on four occasions, right? And what I'm going to discuss now about Ladakh is the way life's change and have changed in the last 40, 50 years for children, adolescents, and so on. Ladakh is a very thinly populated mountain desert, right, partially belonging to the Himalayas, partially to Karakoram Mountains. The last number counting said there were 328,000 Buddhist and Muslim inhabitants for a tehsil that's half as large as Great Britain. That's nothing, right? Because it's almost all of it a sort of a mountain desert, right? Most of the people there used to be farmers or peasants, right? Some were also nomads, right? I'm going to only look at some of the farmers. I went in 1974. Ladakh was opened to foreign visitors. Till then, you couldn't go there because Ladakh is both on the Chinese and the Pakistani border, and there have been many military problems there. Which, again, I'm going to ignore, civil wars. Right? But in the 70s, it was opened. I went there the first time in 77, just 3 years later. And you could tell the old culture, about which I knew quite a bit, was still intact in many, many ways. Right? Then I went back there three more times, the last time in 2000, and I was interviewing various people. Right. Here are a few traditions. One is quite unusual, called fraternal polyandry. It means that when the wife marries the oldest son in a peasant family, she also marries his brothers. So I've met wives who had four husbands. Right? Why is this done? So that the land will not be divided up, because several people, you can't divide up the land and live with it. Right? So that's an unusual custom, and among the older people, you know, I met quite a few of them, even in the year 2000, some of the grandmas and grandpas were still married, but the young generation didn't do this anymore. Right? We're going to see in a moment. Right? Status of women was relatively high, which is generally true among Tibetans, but there was no equality. Right? For instance, religion was mostly a men's business, not entirely. There are nuns, but they have lower status and far fewer in number. Right? Ladakh also, unlike the Amdo nomads, was an unusually peaceful society. Certainly more peaceful than the United States. Right? Here are a few pictures. This is the Mayuru Gompa, a famous monastery, I took this picture in 1980-81. Here we're interviewing some kids in a primary school in a little village. Right? The person on the left is actually the teacher, right? And he has in front of him my questionnaire in Ladakhi, the local Tibetan language, right? And we're asking all sorts of questions, some of which these girls found, and boys, you know, was half and half, found very difficult to answer. Right? This is a very interesting, highly unusual picture. We are in the room of a monk to the right hand, right? A local Ladakhi monk. Right? He's being interviewed by the person in the middle who these days is the dean at York College, City University of New York. The person responsible for arts and sciences. Right? And she was my research assistant in those days. I used to teach there, right? That was one reason. The person on the left is the interpreter translating the questions which are being asked in English into Ladakhi. But if you look at this room, it's rather unusual. Anybody recognizes the picture sort of above the monk? Who is that? Bruce Lee. Yeah. Right? Somewhat odd ideal for a monk, I would say, you know, martial arts specialist. Above his head, that's Oregon. So some tourist brought it along, right? And I find this picture interesting because it shows you how, you know, within a few years, that society was already shifting rapidly. Yeah. This is a young married woman. On her head, she has what's called a perak. She gets it from her mother. It's a sort of like insurance. If there should be a divorce, she can sort of take that with her, right? Even though she will be very unhappy to sell it, right? And it's, depending how fancy it is, it's worth several thousand dollars. An older farmer, right? Almost certainly illiterate. Now, in order to make sense out of this, I'm going to talk about a person whom we shall call Zering Wangchuk. Zering, you already know, very common name, long life, right? Who studies information technology and management in Delhi, the capital of India. So let me first say something about India. India is one of the most varied countries in the world. And it has the second largest population in the world, by far the largest number of children in the world, many more than about 440 million children. That's 120 million more than the total population of the United States. Right? In the year 2024, according to present estimates, its population will be passing the population of China, which at the moment still has about 50 million more people. Right? So the population is younger. There are 22 official languages and more than 800 spoken languages. So culturally speaking, it is more varied than almost any other country that I know. Zering, right, Was born in 1999 in a small little village about 120 miles from the Chinese border. Right. He is the son of a Jeep driver who worked in part for the army. There's a huge army, the Indian army there. And the grandson of an illiterate small little farmer in the village. He speaks the local language, Ladakhi, a form of Tibetan. Right. Urdu and Hindi, two overlapping languages. Urdu is spoken in Pakistan and in Kashmir, right? And Hindi is related to Urdu, but they have different writing systems, right? And the details are not important. And he already learned English in his school, right? Some Ladakhis also speak Balti, which is a... Baltistan is mostly in Pakistan and is a society of Shia Muslims. And some of them live also, quite a few actually live in Ladakh. He's the first one in his family to leave Ladakh and get a tertiary education in Delhi, the capital. That means that he really has three different identities. And he's quite aware of this, right? First, he has his traditional Ladakhi Buddhist identity. Then he is an Indian citizen. But from his point of view, and the point of view of many Ladakhis, the Indians are these people who live in the lowlands and are really different from us. Right? And, of course, Delhi is a huge city, right? So he's also moving from a small village to a huge city. And then he has a transnational identity, because if you study information technology, you live in a partially American English-speaking world, right? And English is widely spoken in India. Many universities teach in English, not in Hindi, especially the more fancy ones. Right? So people sometimes say, hey, in the non-Western world, people are, you know, there's globalization going on, and you have two identities. You know, this is a more global flavor and the more local flavor. In my opinion, in countries like India, often you have three identities. Your local one, right? The big city, national identity, and this semi-global identity. Furthermore, Ladakh itself is exposed to global influences because there are lots of tourists, mostly Europeans, incidentally, not so much Americans. Right. And they have been there since the 70s. Right. And it's sort of interesting. In 77, when I was in Ladakh for the first time, there was really one hotel and otherwise guest houses. A few years later, there were a whole bunch of hotels for those Western tourists, because from a Ladakhi point of view, these Western tourists swim in money. It's obvious to them. Right? So why do the tourists go to Ladakh? A, because of the mountains. Right? We're among the some of the most spectacular mountains on Earth. Right? But B, every year the big monasteries have spectacular festivals where the monks dress up, having masks on, as characters from Tibetan religious history, right? And they dance for a day and a half or so, right? And it's quite a sight. Right? Now when Zering goes to Delhi, he's a minority group member because he is a member of a scheduled tribe. That's a certain Indian way of dealing with minorities. Right? India is becoming more nationalistic. You probably know elections are going on right now, and Modi, if he wins, he's famous for being anti-Muslim and a nationalist and so on and so on. Right. Most people in Delhi who don't know much about Ladakh, it's not exactly the center of India, they think he is probably from the northeast of India because he has a sort of somewhat Mongolian appearance, like many, not all, but many Ladakhis are sort of more or less, quote, Mongoloid, right? So they think he's from one of those backward tribes. And there's quite a bit of prejudice. So he dresses up in Western clothes, maybe occasionally in more Indian clothes, because he doesn't want to be recognized and called a country bumpkin. Right? On the other hand, he has friends. There are now about 10,000 Ladakhi students, and Delhi is not the only place. They go to Chandigarh and a few other places, but Delhi is the biggest place where they go to. Right? So he gets moral reinforcement, right, if things get too tricky. One of his problems will be pretty soon, once he gets a degree, where can he get a job? There are government officials up in Ladakh and so on, but it's very competitive, and his information technology knowledge, he would better get a job somewhere in mainstream India, let's say. Right? So that will be a huge decision. Right? When he gets back to Ladakh, which he often does in the summer, and he will be criticized by his Ladakhi friends, especially in the village, a little bit less in the capital. Right? You don't eat Ladakhi food. Right? He got a little bit used to McDonald's in Delhi. Right? He also missed Ladakhi food while he was in the capital. That's true, but he also got used to Western and Indian mainstream food. Right? Furthermore, you dress not like us, you dress like this man, this person from Delhi. They don't even think it's a tourist stuff, right? Even though he does look like a tourist sometimes with a t-shirt on, right? And furthermore, you don't think like a Ladakhi. You don't feel like a Ladakhi, even though Tsering's main identity, if you would ask him, is to be a Ladakhi and a Buddhist. So it's pretty, pretty tricky. And this is true now in many parts of the world to various degrees, right? So I've sort of emphasized this one person just to say what you see in this situation isn't uncommon. Right? I'll give you just one short little example. I used to have a student working for me who came from Nigeria in Africa. Right, from Lagos, 20 million people. Right, and we would discuss soccer. And he played for the soccer team at my college. Right, but we would discuss African soccer players in the Premier League in London, or in England, and the World Cup and all that stuff. Right. And so he lived in this world that wasn't exactly Nigerian, that wasn't exactly global, right? He spoke English with a strong accent, right? He didn't feel like an American, but he didn't feel any more like a Nigerian either, right? He was sort of somewhere in a no man's land, right? I want to emphasize one more point, and then we're going to go to South Korea. Even though such identities are difficult, because they're really multiple identities, a lot of people I've met, including Ladakhis, sort of can deal with this. Right. So in other words, they shift from one situation to another, right? And they speak Ladakhi, and 10 seconds later they speak in English to somebody else, and so on and so on. They know they're going to be criticized back in Ladakh because they are too Western Indian, whatever you want to call it, right? But the really big decisions they have to make is, for instance, whom to marry. Right? You're supposed to marry another Ladakhi, right? Not somebody from India. You know, Ladakh's part of India, but they say, these Indians, right? Because they don't quite feel they're part of this. Right? That will be a big decision, and needless to say, the family will have something to say. If he meets falls in love with a non-Ladakhi, there will be big trouble. Right? And I give you now one more example. I once interviewed the head of a monastery in Ladakh, who happened to be a Tibetan, not a Ladakhi. So he brought along his Tibetan interpreter, because Tibetan and Ladakhi are rather different. And at the end of the interview, he asked the head of the monastery for advice. Here's his situation. He had fallen in love with an American girl who lived in Dharamsala. That's where the Dalai Lama is, and there are thousands of Americans there. Right? And he wanted to marry her, but his family wasn't happy. What should he do? Right. So, the head of the monastery, sort of interesting, throws what they call a mo, M-O, a mo, sort of like a little drum, and you throw on top of it what we would call popcorn. It's not popcorn, but similar to it. You do like this, and then you are now the head of the monastery. You look at the pattern, and that helps you to make a good decision for that young man who is asking you whether he should or should not marry an American. Right? So it's this prediction, right, that is a Tibetan Buddhist Ladakhi tradition, still followed, right? And it's being used to help this young man to make a rather big decision about his identity, because it's obvious that this is at stake, among other things, and his relationship to his family. Right? I don't know what he did ultimately. Right? I met him exactly once because he went back to Dharamsala, but it was sort of interesting to see all of this, right? This sort of combination of the old Buddhist culture and that decision that 30 years earlier he wouldn't have had to make because there were no Americans there. Okay, so now we're going to hear about South Korea from Dr. Kim.
Okay. Okay. now we are going to have a big shift. Regarding of the regional shift from the middle size of the Asia, or frequently called the Southern Asia, to the East Asian region, and at the same time, lifestyle-wise, it is a big shift, I think. And then at the same time, however, although in our book, the South Korean community and then the cases of children's lifestyle actually introduced as a representative of IT-driven society is one. But I can say there are many different parts of the their children's lifestyles, and then their challenges, and then their future compared to other IT-based society, most developed ones over the globe. So I'm going to pinpoint certain parts, particularly in today's presentation, rather than just going over just overall what is going on in South Korea, particularly children's and adolescents' lifestyles. Because even President Obama mentioned South Korean education system several times in his resume as a one of the really exemplar and then very effective and then really producing many positive aspects of children's life and then educational outcomes. However, many South Koreans even worried about that mentioning because it may draw a slightly different picture what we believe and what we feel about our education system and then the reality of children's and adolescents' life there, living there, just looking at this surface level higher and then promising educational outcomes that South Korean community actually shows. So I'm going to highlighting some aspects, not well-known, but it sounds like really extreme or even crazy for many people in the world. So first of all, childhood aspects of South Koreans. So many people have heard, again, South Koreans emphasize educational achievement even younger years, but have you heard English kindergarten? So this specific private English education institute or programs, it is actually very expensive, like more than $1,000 a month as a tuition for very young children like pre-K or K age level. So why they do this one? Because English skills, overall their academic achievements all the way up to 12th grade, even in college level, are very critically important for them. Personally, I don't know, I don't understand very clearly that much because our lifetime living in South Korea, not I am here living in the United States, very limited number of cases you actually talk to English native speakers. Your lifetime. Even now, globalized, you're working for a companies like Samsung or LG or Hyundai. Possibly some countable number of workers there actually dealing with many international trade or directly talk to someone else other side of the globe. But these just ordinary people, they have possibly 10 times at most their lifetime. They can talk to directly to native English speaker. So why they really matters? Personally, I don't know really. But English skills, really, really important one. Possibly number one, that you can show your academic competency. If you're really good at English, that is automatically you are very good at academics. So that is the reason here, even very young children, if you have, you're going to plan to send them to English kindergarten, where those young children actually interact with native English speakers. Okay, from 9 to 3 every day, for example. So that's one nature of how they are really focusing on their educational attainment from even younger years. Now, many people, and it is relatively well known because Western media reported many times Hagwon, which is usually it is translated into cram schools, and then it's also private ones other than your regular school system. So even younger years, like first grade, second grade, you're going to start your life in cram schools after you actually come back from your general class and then school. And then you go to there, even like this, These are shuttle buses. They transfer these young children out of school. It's just in front of a school, elementary school, and then riding on a shuttle bus, transferring those students directly from their official school system to the current school system. And then they directly go there and then start learning English again, and then math, and then other subjects. This is general here, this part of the picture, upper left corner, just general classroom setting. It's not very specifically different from other kind of countries or societies, but this lower right corner, this is what I can say. It is a kind of typical example of cram school. So it's a much smaller space, and then a lot less number of students actually attending one class, and then they're studying over and over again their academic subjects, or even to go to in advance. They're studying like some children in elementary school, they studying middle school math. They're studying high school English like that. To go further, to go faster than their peers, they do these things every day and then every month. And then most well-known and then popular subject in cram school situation, English and math, like this. English and math is top number two subjects here. And then it is kind of a multiple answers system. So 73.5% of students in cram school, they taking English course. And then now more than half of them also are taking math. Other music or language art or fine arts following, but clearly English and then math classes are prevalent and then predominant here. So other focus for them is, as I mentioned, learning in advance. So elementary school students, they have to go in some middle school math or English classes, and then you can say, oh, my children really are academically advanced. And then their academic competence is in a good shape, and then they're going to succeed over and over again upcoming years. Then they have emphasizing this kind of achievement, and then they spend a lot of money, and then that. This is a kind of data showing that trend. So for sixth graders, replied some questionnaire and survey, 627 sixth graders answered they are working on seventh grade math or English. 27%. And then 13.6% of sixth graders, they are working on eighth grade English. And then still roughly 10% of them even in ninth grade English classes. So that's how they are very passionate about how you can advance and then going up for upper level classes. While you're in school system, you're sixth graders, but you have to go up to show academic preparedness. This is one picture I introduced, English kindergarten. So children surrounded here, and then however, this English native speaker as a teacher. And then it's fairly expensive, and then, however, very popular among Korean parents and then children. Students. Now, do they want? Those children actually love this kind of situation? They enjoy everything? Actually, no. Because this kind of data showing what they want after they go come home from school. 61% of those children, they would like to take rest at home. And then roughly half of them also like to play with their friends. However, in reality, they can't do that. So more than half of them, they go to cram school, private education, or tutoring. They also, another half of them, it's a multiple answering question here. They have to complete their homework, clearly, and then heavy kind of workload there. And then now another considerable number of students actually after school, and then after school system also they're attending like this. So it is their reality. They want something else. So see, it's a stressful situation for young children, even go up advanced level of classes, but they don't have enough time to rest. They don't have enough time to play with their friends or even build up some social network by themselves. Now, adolescents. What is going on, middle school students and in high school students? It is kind of extension of this higher level of focusing on education achievement system. Well, we've heard from Dr. Gillen how teenagers or childhood children actually help their parents and then their younger siblings. But in South Korea, if you try to do some cooking or even you try to washing dishes, your parents may yell at you. Go back your room and then study. That is what they are told many times in their daily life. Why they do that? This South Korean SAT, college entrance exam, is extremely competitive because they will have some national ranking out of that one time yearly administered Korean SAT system. There's no second chance if you fail or if you are sick on that day. There's no second chance. You have to wait another year to take it again next. So that's how it goes. And then that is how it is critical for students. At the same time, their parents, even for many people, because they have a little bit younger children, they're not necessarily taking that year's SAT, but they're focusing on their children's tests upcoming. So almost everybody really, really crazy about that SAT, even for 20 minutes or 30 minutes when the English listening test questions actually being administered national level, and then even all airports shut down for taking off planes for 30 minutes because they will hinder those students, right, from clearly listening to what is being said to their ears, English sentences. So they shut down for about 20 or 30 minutes, all taking off planes for that period of time. So even many companies actually delay their workers' commuting time. It's now delayed to like 10 a.m. Usually it is 8 a.m. or 9 a.m. So that all students get and then report their testing site on time. So many aspects here, wandering around this Korean SAT system, is really, really stressful for many students, and then it's a lifetime kind of moment for them, 12 years of preparation of this particular exam, so that you can go to your dream school and then continue your most important educational dream over more years. And then also school GPA. It is very crazy idea. I talked to some other students I meet here in the United States. It is highly prohibited in United States high school system, but Korean high schools, they post class ranking on the net, their bulletin board, so that everyone can see who is at what ranking in their class. So that's how even make all students compete each other and then really, really stressed out from all these situations and then their mind are filled with this educational burden more and more. And then even Olympiad or other science or other math competition, very important for them to make some difference from their peers. If you have the good ranking or good mentioning from those competition, you are really beneficial when you apply for your dream school after all. So they are also really passionate preparing themselves for this kind of outside competition even. And then what's going on in overall in this highly competitive, very stressful situation then? Here, most students are unhappy about this. They're really pressured by these all situations. And even I've heard from time to time from South Korean media report, even school ranking number one student in a local high school, for example, actually committed suicide. So even top level students, are they happy? They're not happy at all because they have to maintain their ranking, even national level. So nobody can be happier here in this kind of situation. Here, less academically prepared students, they are unhappy because of their ranking. So higher advanced students also, they are really stressed out to maintain their rankings. So it is very, very unhealthy situation for those South Korean students. That actually ended up, particularly among adolescents, highest, always is competing with Japanese adolescents, number one or number two, over year and year, here among OECD, 30 or so OECD countries. One number one suicidal rate, South Korean adolescents actually mark, sadly. Now what's going on if after they actually enter some colleges? Still, these academic achievements are very critical for them. What we call specification. Have you tried to purchase some here technology devices, and then you are looking at some specification of your devices, the CPU speed or RAM size or what is the total size of the your screen? This specification actually here being told among Koreans, what is your academic achievements? What is your GPA? What did you experience? Or have you 1 year ESL experience overseas? So this kind of nature still being used, compete each other, prove or show your academic competency after all. And then to find better job, even for medical students, it is number one nowadays program, very popular among high school students, where you'd like to go to, what program you actually would like to study, medical program. Even those medical students, highly competitive over high school years, and then they go to the medical school, they compete each other to become most popular, right, specialty kind of doctors, like particularly plastic surgeon nowadays, number one, popular one. And then compared to the other just general surgeon or internal medicine or OB-GYN, they are really, really unpopular nowadays. Very, very demanding in terms of their physical strength, and then even you have to be ready for those many OB-GYN kind of doctors, right? So here, they compete even academically to get that kind of outcomes or goals they actually dreamed about. So it is this ongoing situation. Other just general college students, they compete also against each other to get in like a company like Samsung or LG or Hyundai. Globally well-known, very big enterprise, so that you can get better salary, better benefits. They actually still compete very harsh way in college years. Like afterwards, however, there are so many overqualified, actually, people. Look, college entrance level among high school students is already over 80% in South Korea. 80% of high school students actually enter any kind of colleges. So, however, our size of the pie of the social benefits, quality job, and then dream level of salary, not enough for those 80% of college graduate, for example. Then, what's going to happen? So many college graduates actually remain in the education system, either go to the graduate program because they fail to find a dream job. They fail to get into the dream companies, for example. They stay there, not pursuing other lesser beneficial job or lesser popular companies. They forget it, just stay there to see another chance. But many cases, it's not enough because limited resources there. So it is how hard for them. So it is unemployed rate hidden particularly because they're in the education system. They are not counted job seekers. However, including all those hidden aspects of the unemployed rate is really, really problematic nowadays. So young adults are not happy. Even later on, adulthood, so even imagine, you now get a job, you get married, and then having children, what is going to happen? You have to take care of your children's education then. So I can say, even here, wrapping up, so here, South Koreans, and then my society is kind of, I can say, Republic of Education. Here from your own young years, you have to study. And then now you graduated, and then you have a job, and then soon you have a child, and then you have to take care of your child or your children's education. And then until your children get out of school system and get a job, and then have a family, so lifelong. You can't escape this educational focus and an educational, I can say, fever. And then well-known terms nowadays for many people interested in education. So I'm going to quick overview why this one is actually happening in South Korea. Three aspects. I call this one, I read this one, Sanongongsang. It's this well-known traditional value. It is kind of order in society, like educated people respected very most, first. And then peasants, and then skillful engineers, for example, compared to the concurrent job system, and then merchants, businessmen. So this order still there in our mind, traditional and cultural mind. And then if you're educated, even you're poor a little bit compared to the other people. But if you are educated, like having PhD degree, like me exactly, I'm poorer a little bit, but I have PhD, and then you're respected by other people easily because of this cultural idea. So doctors and then lawyers and then teachers having this this term educated in it in our mind. And then secondly, so we have, as I briefly introduced, very limited resources. So the size of the pie is very relatively small compared to the people here seeking for more and better. So another good kind of comparison I can make is if you, for example, if you're not very good at schools in America, you still have some opportunities to succeed in this society. And then you're not necessarily respected if you are bad at school, for example. But in Korea, if you're bad at school and then you're not respected even or not welcome by other people very well, and then even if it's lifelong. So, yeah. And then job, and then you having some trouble finding some good mates as a spouse, it is not very easy for them. Now even this college entrance exam, I can connect this current version of Korean SAT to historic civil service entrance service exam. So very long time, like more than 500 years, Korean society traditionally, at that time actually dynasty, having civil service exams. So literally anybody can take, although many noblemen only take that exam, but literally it is well open to anybody to take that exam, the chances to take it. And then if you're good at those exams, and then you can serve in the government. And then it will change your life entirely. It's a kind of life turning point of kind of achievement for your even lifelong, no doubt, your upcoming generation. They're gonna memorize your achievement, right, over and over again. So that is for many people's mind at that moment of time, even still in our mind, I believe, somehow making our education fever, not educational overall outcomes, but only focus on test scores, your national ranking, what school you can go into, what program you are studying, what kind of job you are actually getting. So that's what I try to introduce this Korean education system. Okay.
Yeah, I want to add one other thing. East Asian societies, including Singapore, Taiwan, South Korea, Japan, and China, all have very low birth rates. So Korean population is about to shrink. The Japanese population is already shrinking, right? The Chinese population still has a few more years, but pretty soon it's going to shrink too, in 15 or whatever the predictions are. Right? And these countries have been trying to get their young women to marry and have more children. Right? And so far as I know, South Korea has not been successful at this. Japan has not been successful at it. China, you know, introduced the two-child policy. Last year, the birth rate again dropped. Right. So, there is a pretty fundamental problem here in these East Asian societies. European societies, incidentally, especially East European societies, have a similar problem. Right. So now we're going to just for a moment look at the world at large, and we can start with something very simple. How many people are there on this earth? Right? And how many will there be in the future as far as we can predict? Right? So in 1800 it was basically 1 billion. Now we have 7.6 billion. And the predictions right now are it's going to be about 11 billion before it levels out. Right. So this is a huge increase, and it is a fundamental cause, not the only one, for all our global warming problems. Right. Now, why this huge increase? Here is the single most, not the only one, but the single most important factor, child mortality rates. Right? So the blue one part, the lower part, is the percentage of children dying in their first 5 years. The yellow one is how many are surviving. Notice in 1800, the about 40+% of all children around the world died within the first 5 years of their lives. Now, It is less than 5% around the world in industrialized countries such as Korea, Japan, Germany. It's about 0.3% to 0.4%. The United States is 0.7%, meaning twice as many as in Germany. Even though it's very, very low, the United States is not the leader when it comes to health systems. Maybe that's no surprise to you, but that also the life expectancy, Japan has about the highest, right? Then come some Scandinavian countries, and again, the U.S., even though high, is number 15, number 18, or whatever. So that child mortality decline is drastic. Among Tibetan nomads, it's very hard to get good numbers, but I suspect that the numbers were at least 50%. In India, in the year 1900, 52% of all children didn't make it into adulthood. Now it's about 4.5%, which is roughly the worldwide average. Right. So that's an astonishing change, right? And I give you now one more example. We looked at Mayans, farmers in Guatemala and Mexico, and we looked at one village because there was a very, very good study on this village. In 1990, the average woman had 7 children. In the United States, the average woman now has about 1.85 children, called total fertility rate. In the United States, the total fertility rate in 1800 was 7 children. So it dropped from 7 to 1.85. And the same is true in many other countries, more or less. Right. So on the one hand, it's wonderful that children don't die anymore, except in a few cases. On the other hand, it also means that there's a large increase in spite, let me repeat, of the fact that fertility, that the number of children is now much less. Here's the global decline between 1950 and 2015. So basically, it dropped by half within 65 years. It's still dropping, but now it's sort of dropping less. I'll tell you a moment why. Global literacy rate. Since we just talked about education, right, in the year 1800, about 12% of all people could read and write at least to a modest degree. Right. Now the rate is up to 85%. Right, and notice how fast it changed, especially from the 60s to about 2010. So if you would have met a Tibetan nomad, chances were he couldn't read and write, or she couldn't read and write. Right? But farmers couldn't read and write either, and that was true whether you're in China, whether you are in India, or whether you are in Africa. Right? The only exceptions to this, partial exceptions, were certain Protestant countries, like Sweden had a relatively high literacy rate even in the early 19th century. U.S., also Protestant basically in those days, right, also had a relatively high literacy rates. Right? The gender ratios. Gender ratio of 20%, for instance, means that 20% of all, that the ratio between men and women is that 20% as many women as men can read and write. So they are much, much less likely to be able to read and write. Right? Notice not the absolute ratio, it's the gender ratio. Right? So look at the 1870s, which isn't that long ago. Right? And for instance, sub-Saharan Africa, almost no women could read and write. Right? The number of men was small, but it was much higher. Right? Today, in 2010, if you now look at the two top lines, right, Latin American, right, and advanced economies, that's basically Europe, North America, and East Asia, right, it's basically 100%. In fact, in some countries now, and increasingly so, more women than men, or more girls than boys, go to school. That's one of the most drastic changes. It tells you something about gender roles, how drastically this has shifted. Now, let me say something for a moment about the situation in different parts of the world. The continent with the lowest rates of income and of reading and writing is Africa, and specifically sub-Saharan Africa. Right. So there are still countries like Chad, Niger, Burkina Faso, which is sort of a little bit north of the equator, right, Mali, where a very large number of children cannot read and write, right? even there the number is slowly increasing, right? And where the fertility rates are far higher than they are in the industrialized countries. For instance, the country with the highest fertility rate is Niger, not Nigeria, but Niger, right? Agricultural country in sub-Saharan Africa, 7.5 children per woman per lifetime. Almost exactly like those 7 children among the Mayas in the past, but not now, or the 7 children among United States citizens in 1800 who were largely rural. Okay. Right now, Africa has 1.25 billion people, 1,250,000,000. In the year 2050, that will have doubled. It will be 2.5 billion people. So in Africa alone, there will be 2.5 as many people as in the whole world in 1800. One area where you also have lots of children who still work and cannot read and write, but where things are shifting now rapidly, is South Asia. India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nepal. Sri Lanka is a little bit different, but it's a small country. Right? In Bangladesh, right, which is a predominantly Muslim country, the fertility rate dropped considerably within 20 years. Right? It is still higher than industrialized countries, but compared to what it was like as recently as 20 years, the shift is dramatic. In India, it depends on where you are in India because India is so varied. Right? In the south, you now have fertility rates that are about the same as in Europe. And in fact, Sweden's and France's fertility rates are now higher than in parts of southern India. That has never been true. It wasn't true 10 years ago. In northern India, you still have relatively but sinking fertility rates. That's why India will have the largest population on Earth, probably about 1.8 billion in about 30, 35 years, and that will level out. Africa and South Asia are the two poorest regions in the world. It is true India has had rather high economic growth rates in the last 15 years, so it's shifting. Right? Africa is much slower to shift. Right? So exactly where the countries are the poorest, that's where you have not only the most children, but you're going to have even more children in the future, and especially so in Africa. Right? In contrast, European countries and East Asian countries, such as South Korea, have exactly the opposite problem. So South Korea is now heading towards a birth rate of maybe 1.2, 1.3. Singapore is about 1.0. Big cities have lower birth rates than rural areas. China is about 1.6. Taiwan is about 1.2. Right? Notice that none of those countries except China ever had a one or two child policy. Right? You could have as many children as you wanted in South Korea. But you heard why they don't have them. Right? Education craziness is not the only reason, but it surely is a powerful reason. And then I think we're just about finished. Let me make one more little point. One interesting difference between traditional childhood and modern childhood has to do with education. In other words, if you grew up in a traditional family, pretty much throughout most of the world, until rather recently in many cases, or even now. Okay? From early on, where you were educated to marry early and to work your whole life, not to go to school, right? And to learn by observation. Right. How do you learn how to cook tortillas or plant plants? I remember once talking to a group of doctoral students at Pace University, and when I said this, I said, "What do you mean 20s? I'm 35 and still in school, right?" Now, of course, that's PhD students and so on, right? But you see the same trend. You surely see it in South Korea, right? So it's not east or west. It is not whether you're an individualistic country like the U.S. or a more collectivistic country like Japan or Korea, whatever. Right? It seems like a worldwide trend, and it's probably the most basic trend changing children's lives. Creating adolescence where it didn't exist. Right? Many girls in India married at age 15 or earlier. Right. Creating what's now called emerging adulthood, 18 to 26, you know, all those college students who may or may not marry. The percentage of students marrying in the United States is dropping. Right? And when I ask my students, you know, who of you is going to have seven children, they just stare at me and laugh. Right? Of course, I know that, right? It's absurd for them. And yet, that used to be